From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. U.S. pressure has apparently succeeded in blocking Russia from sending aid to Syria through Bulgarian airspace. That followed efforts by the U.S. to force Greece to close its airspace to Russia. On Monday, the Greek Foreign Ministry announced that it had received a U.S. request to close its airspace for flights of Russian aircraft with cargo for Syria. Athens said that Russia had chosen a route on the east of Greece for the delivery of that aid. Also Monday, Bulgaria refused to provide the air corridor to Russia for that purpose. An article in Russia's TASS news agency reported Wednesday that Moscow confirmed Russian specialists were in Syria helping the Syrian army use Russian military equipment. Moscow said its military equipment supplies to Syria were being done in compliance with international law. Maria Zakharova, a spokesperson for the foreign ministry, said Wednesday that Russia had, quote, never made a secret of military technical cooperation with Syria, closed quote, adding that Moscow has long been supplying weapons and military equipment to Syria, quote, under existing contracts and in full conformity with international law, closed quote. Zakharova confirmed the presence of, quote, Russian military specialists in Syria who helped to use arriving equipment, closed quote. She added that more might be forthcoming, saying, quote, Russia might consider extra counterterrorism aid to Syria, closed quote. She added that such aid would only be considered and done in compliance with international law. NATO Secretary General Anders Rasmussen expressed concern over the reports of Russia's aid to Syria and warned that any military support to the Syrian government would escalate the crisis. To many in the U.S., particularly in the Western media, the new posturing over Syria, where the U.S. has recently claimed authority to bomb and otherwise engage any and all threats to its own proxy forces, including threats posed by the forces of the Syrian army against its proxies, has taken on the appearance of a Cold War struggle. But it's been 70 years since the Cold War began and was defined in the minds of Americans by government officials and a media that had suffered several massive purges despite its relatively compliant nature, and it's been 25 years since it was declared over, with most Americans lacking all but the faintest memory of what it was all about. The narrative was essentially that of a Hollywood movie, one made after the purge of Hollywood, exemplified by the case of the Hollywood 10. The U.S. was the sheriff that had saved the world, including the Russians, from Hitler, and an ungrateful Moscow, using communist subversion, was determined to conquer the world. But the Hollywood script that was sold in the media, schools, and the culture in general doesn't tell the story at all. The Cold War period actually included hot wars that took millions of lives in places like Korea, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Greece, Guatemala, Congo, Angola, and many other places. Brian Becker from the Party for Socialism and Liberation discusses the so-called Cold War, that half-century conflict between the U.S. and what was called in the West the Communist Menace. He spoke last week with Liberation Radio's Ernesto Aguilar.
It was considered cold as opposed to hot, meaning it wasn't like the global war in World War II, which led to the deaths of 70 million people, and the countries were sending armies into each other's territories and bombing their cities, or like World War I, where not as many, but probably 25 or 30 million people died. The Cold War was a global struggle between two adversaries, but not hot, meaning they weren't bombing each other's cities. And that's why it got the language of Cold War. From the PSL's point of view, the Cold War is largely a confusing term. First of all, big parts of the Cold War weren't cold. They were very hot. 5 million Koreans died between 1950 and 1953, according to the Encyclopedia Britannica. That was the Cold War for Koreans, not cold at all. And millions of Vietnamese died between 1950 and 54 when they defeated the French, and then when the U.S. took up the role of the French colonists and attempted to maintain the power of imperialism through the vehicle of the puppet government in South Vietnam. Also not a Cold War. But even more importantly than the fact that there were hot parts of the Cold War, meaning real wars where people were dying in large numbers. The Cold War terminology is confusing because it doesn't show the class nature of this global conflict. What made the Cold War different from World War I and World War II, two other global wars, was not only one was cold and the other was hot, it was also because World War I and, for the most part, World War II were wars between different camps of imperialists and colonizers over who would control the colonies and spheres of influence in Africa, in the Middle East, in Asia, in Latin America. The world had been thoroughly divided by the colonizing powers by the beginning of the 20th century, and both World War I and World War II were an attempt to sort of reorganize labor markets and control over spheres of influence by the new imperialist capitalist economies of the 20th century. In the case of the Cold War, all of those imperialists who had fought against each other in World War I and World War II were united as part of an anti-communist united front. Instead of them fighting with each other and having inter-imperialist rivalry over colonies, they united with each other under the leadership of U.S. imperialism, which was the sole superpower in the imperialists, to carry out a war against the Soviet Union and the other socialist bloc countries who were in alliance with the national liberation movements that had become the dominant post-World War II political feature in the colonized world. Africa, Asia, Latin America, the Middle East was standing up, becoming independent, freeing themselves from the old imperialists. The colonial system had been so weakened and then destroyed by virtue of the just catastrophic levels of death and destruction in World War II. The old systems of global power had been shattered, and those colonized people were rising up, taking advantage of that shattering to become independent and free. And to a very large extent, they were looking towards the socialist bloc, Soviet Union, the non-colonizing section of the world, for military, economic, diplomatic, and political assistance as they attempted to become first independent and then sovereign and controlling their own resources in the face of the colonizing or imperialist world. So it was a global confrontation that went on for almost a half a century that included hot wars and so-called Cold War, but a confrontation nonetheless, and largely on a class basis rather than an inter-imperialist basis. In other words, the rivalry was like the struggle between workers and bosses, except the workers now had some state power. They had state power in Soviet Union. They had state power in China. They had state power in North Korea and in Vietnam, and through a different process in the Eastern and Central European countries as well. So the working class, for the first time, had state power, not just in one, but multiple countries, and the imperialists were completely committed as a top priority to destroy those socialist working class-led governments, those communist-led governments. And of course, because the Soviet Union was considered the anchor, the real anchor of the socialist bloc, it was the Soviet Union that was targeted first and foremost by world imperialism, led by U.S. imperialism, in what we know as the Cold War.
You mentioned World War II. The Soviet Union and the United States were military allies during that war. Was there any possibility that that alliance could have continued?
Well, the Soviet Union was the only major entity within World War II which was not an imperialist country. It was, in fact, drawn into World War II because Germany, the Nazi-led German military, invaded Soviet Union in June 1941. 80% of Hitler's entire military was sent to the Soviet Union. It was the largest single military operation in human history. 4 million German Nazi-led military invaded the Soviet Union. And so the Soviet Union had to fight. They weren't fighting for colonies or spheres of influence. They were fighting to defend themselves from the invasion, the Nazi invasion. Because Britain and the United States were also the adversaries of Nazi Germany, they formed a military alliance with the Soviet Union purely as a matter of military expediency. In other words, there was no other basis of the relationship. In fact, they lent money to the Soviet Union through the Lend-Lease program. They were technically allies. They met during the war. They met in Tehran in 1943. and then Yalta, and then Potsdam in 1944 and 45. In other words, they were the allies, Britain, Soviet Union, and the United States. But the last 2 years of World War II, and you can see as you study how the war unfolded, was really the beginning of a struggle between the allies once they knew the war would be won. Once they knew that Germany and Japan and Italy were to be defeated, the question really was, what would the post-war look like? And, you know, in the popular presentation in the West, what we've told is that the Soviet Union emerged out of World War II as a major power, and that it had imperial expansionist designs, that was evidenced by what happened in Eastern and Central Europe, where those countries became socialist bloc countries, and that the United States was fighting to hold back the flood, the global tide of world communism, which became synonymous with totalitarianism. In other words, the presentation in the West was the Cold War was a struggle between enlightened Western democracy and totalitarianism led by the communists, the Soviet Union. And the reality, though, is this. The United States had two principal fears in the last 2 years of World War II. One was the rising tide of leftist revolutionary activity and power both in Europe and in Asia, and against the growing power of the Soviet Union, which, in spite of all odds, was able to not only defeat Nazism as it invaded the Soviet Union in 1941 and 42 and 43, but launch a major, massive counteroffensive that liberated Eastern and Central Europe from the Nazi yoke. And so the United States was principally concerned with Soviet power as a global power and thought of it as being inherently, fundamentally in alliance with a rising tide of socialist, leftist, revolutionary activity that was sweeping the world, and particularly in Asia, as a consequence of the dislocations and misery caused by World War II. And so even in the last months and days of World War II, it became clear that the United States government, the imperialist Western governments led by the United States, that their principal agenda was to defeat the left in Italy and in France, defeat the left in Vietnam, defeat the left in Korea, defeat the left in the Philippines, defeat the left in China. That was the goal, and they realized or felt that the principal reason the left forces would gain strength was not only the destruction of the old colonial world systems, but also because they had an ally in the Soviet Union. So the United States started targeting the USSR as part of what it considered to be its fundamental fear, which was the rising tide of revolution throughout the world. In the case of the Soviet Union, the Stalin leadership would have been quite happy to have maintained and did want to maintain the relationship with the United States and Britain. In fact, you can see by the way Stalin and the Soviet leadership oriented their foreign policy towards Asia and towards Europe that they did not want to be identified with or seen as the motor force for an anti-imperialist or anti-capitalist revolution. And so the Soviet Union had what I consider to be a fairly conservative foreign policy orientation at the end of World War II. They weren't trying to promote world revolution. World revolution was starting to happen, but Stalin and the Soviet leadership didn't really want that. They knew that imperialism would hold them responsible for a global revolutionary thrust. And what the Soviets wanted and what Stalin wanted more than anything was a respite from confrontation. The war in the Soviet Union was so vastly catastrophic, 27 million Soviet people died. 27 million, when you compare that to the United States, which also had large casualties, but about 400,000 Americans died. The Soviets lost 27 million. Vast parts of the Soviet Union had been destroyed by the war. Their industry, agriculture. The Soviets really wanted peace, but they didn't have an opportunity for peace because it was Truman and Churchill and the other imperialists, principally located in the United States, but also the British to a lesser degree, who decided that their main goal after World War II was to revive their defeated enemies, revive Germany, revive Japan, make them strong again economically and militarily, even though they had just laid waste to them, dropped atomic bombs on Japan, for instance. The American occupation that came immediately after the surrender of Japan was in order to prop up the same political and economic establishment, the elites in Japan and Germany, to weld them together as part of a global front, united front against communism. And that was the difference. The U.S. agenda was to take all of the Soviets' enemies, revive them, and to revive all of the other capitalist powers in order to wage a relentless struggle against what they consider to be the real enemy. And it's so interesting, isn't it, that big sections of the German establishment, with the exception of maybe a handful of Nazis who were convicted at Nuremberg and executed, the great bulk of the German Nazi establishment was completely rehabilitated. And they became the judges in the economic and political infrastructure of West Germany. Their scientific establishment, the Nazi scientific establishment, in very large numbers were brought to the United States to be the leaders of what then became NASA and the U.S. space program. And when those Nazis came over to the United States and when asked, well, how do you feel about fighting alongside as opposed to the United States? They said, well, you know, we always had a shared real enemy, and that was communism in the Soviet Union. And so you could see the U.S. really did everything in its power to fight against the Soviet Union. That's how the Cold War started. And that is what made the possibility of an enduring alliance that began in World War II as a military contingency, made that impossible to continue in spite of the fact that Stalin and the Soviet Union would have very, very much preferred it.
I want to ask you to dive a little deeper on some of these subjects, because the popular idea from the West is that the USSR had imperial aspirations, that Eastern Europe was going to be its satellite in this regard. And thus, the Cold War was premised in this idea of democracy versus totalitarianism. Now, in the PSL's perspective, what was the primary agenda of the Soviet leadership after World War II, and what was the driving force behind U.S. policy?
The Soviet leadership after World War II had a couple primary priorities. The first one was to make sure that Eastern and Central Europe, Poland and Bulgaria and Romania, and of course the Western Soviet republics like Ukraine, would not become again a staging ground for an imperialist invasion into Russia and into the Soviet Union. They were hoping that those countries would have officially neutral governments and that there would be an agreement between the United States and the Soviets, that there could be a new world order whereby the Soviets would not feel threatened again on their border by regimes that were either so right-wing or fascist as they had been before World War II, or so much functioning as a proxy of Western imperialist forces, that those lands would be used again as a staging ground. Austria was an example of what the Soviets would have liked, a neutralized Eastern or Central Europe. But instead, the United States, through the agency of the Cold War, targeted or fomented the reorganization of the most right-wing clerical and semi-fascist forces in Eastern and Central Europe, who, of course, were opposed to the fact that the Red Army had liberated those countries from fascism. In other words, the United States was sort of organically drawn to the most right-wing and semi-fascist forces in Eastern and Central Europe and promoting them because they were anti-Soviet. They were anti-communist, and the U.S. was principally trying to stop what they saw as the global tide of revolution. So to the extent that the United States insisted on right-wing, anti-communist governments in Eastern and Central Europe, that also became a motor force or a motivating force for the Soviet leadership, the Stalin leadership, to begin the process later in the 1940s, not in 1945, not 1946 or 47, starting in 47, to begin to put into power in Eastern and Central Europe governments that were socialist governments, in other words, led by the Communist Party, governments that they knew would be allied governments and wouldn't allow those countries to be used for NATO or other Western military alliances. But again, Stalin did that as a last resort. It wasn't part of a grand imperial expansionist design. It was because of Western aggressiveness that refused to allow Eastern and Central Europe to be neutral that forced Stalin and the Soviet Union to take additional measures to socialize these governments sort of from the top down. In other words, not from an indigenous revolution as happened in Russia, for instance. But you can see that Stalin and the orientation of the communist movement that, of course, took its leadership from Moscow after World War II, they did not promote revolution in Italy. They did not promote revolution in France. In both Italy and in France, the partisans who led the struggle against fascists were primarily led by the Communist Party. Those were mass parties. They had gained tremendous prestige and authority because they were the leaders of the fight against Nazism and occupation. They had guns. They had armies. They had partisan armies. When World War II ended, France and Italy were in ruins. The communists could have taken a bold move for state power at that time. The Soviet leadership clearly was not in favor of the French or Italian communist parties taking power. In fact, they promoted their idea that they should lay their guns down and that they should enter into electoral politics as a way of participating in the post-war society. In other words, Stalin and the Soviet leadership signaled the United States that Italy and France would remain part of the capitalist imperialist world. And to the extent that revolutions in Greece or in Yugoslavia, because of the indigenous orientation of the Greek communists in Greece or the Yugoslav communists under Tito's leadership in Yugoslavia, to the extent that those leaderships continued the armed struggle against the old ruling elites, you could see by the way the Soviet leadership oriented towards it, they weren't really supportive. They were not supporting and, in fact, held back arms from Greece. The relations between Stalin and the Soviet leadership and Tito in 1946 and 47 were strained prior to the final break between them in 1948-49. But that's because the Soviets did not dominate the direction of those struggles. And clearly the Soviet leadership was worried that if there was a revolution in Italy or France or Greece, which could very possibly have won, they knew that the United States would hold the Soviet Union responsible for those socialist revolutions. They would say this was a Soviet communist conspiracy. And they also know that the U.S. imperialism had just dropped the atomic bomb twice on Japan, that they had a monopoly on nuclear weapons, that they were oriented towards another global confrontation with the Soviet Union, including the use of nuclear weapons when the Soviets at that time did not have nuclear weapons. For all of those reasons, the Stalin leadership took a defensive, conservative orientation, not an aggressive, revolutionary orientation. It's not to affix blame and say, should he have or should the Soviets have had that policy or another policy, but it's to have an objective assessment of what was driving Soviet policy at that time.
Let's shift our focus a bit right now, branch out from Soviet Union and the United States to Asia, Korea, Vietnam, China. What was the impact of the Cold War on Asia?
Well, here too, what happened in Asia was the Asian counterpart to what was going on in Europe, but played out very, very differently than Europe. Asia was aflame with revolution as a consequence of the destruction of the British and French colonial empire, and those were shattered by World War II, and then the defeat of Japan, which had replaced the British and the French as the new colonial power in Asia. The destruction of those colonial networks that had been in place for centuries became a catalyst for indigenous revolutions in Korea, in the Philippines, in Vietnam, and everywhere, in India, Indonesia, everywhere throughout Asia, which had been so brutally colonized. Asia was on fire. And the reality is the Soviet leadership orientation towards Asia was also conservative. It was not promoting world revolution in Asia. It's just that they could not contain the revolution in Asia. In 1945, and I think this is very important for everyone to know, and some know, but many do not know, the Soviet leadership, again under Stalin, signed the Soviet-Sino, meaning the Soviet-Chinese Treaty, in 1945, not with Mao Zedong, but with Chiang Kai-shek, with the Kuomintang, with the nationalist forces who were fighting and had been fighting and using all the Western aid that they were receiving in World War II to fight mainly against the communists. The Soviet leadership signed the Sino-Soviet Treaty with Chiang Kai-shek and recognized Chiang Kai-shek as the legitimate government in China. And that's when the communist-led army by Mao's army controlled vast parts of China. It wasn't like they were just a political party. They already controlled huge parts of China, but still the Soviet leadership said, no, Chiang Kai-shek is the legitimate government of China. In other words, they were not as a priority certainly promoting Chinese revolution led by the Chinese Communist Party. In the case of Vietnam, the Stalin leadership at the end in the last negotiated conferences was prepared to have a trusteeship over Vietnam, which would allow the different powers, the victorious powers, to have a mutual authority over Vietnam. and that independence for Vietnam would be pushed off 20 or 30 years. In other words, they wanted to have an orientation towards Vietnam similar to what they had in Germany, where France, Britain, the Soviet Union, and the United States partitioned Germany immediately after World War II into zones of occupation. The Soviets were prepared to do the same in Vietnam and in Korea, meaning that they weren't promoting the Vietnamese Revolution. But the Vietnamese Revolution was an indigenous revolution, just like the Korean Revolution was an indigenous revolution. The people were fighting. The old colonial orders had become undone. And even though the Soviets were signaling the West that they weren't really promoting these revolutions just kept going and going and going. And the corruption in China, the disgusting, decadent corruption of Chiang Kai-shek and the Kuomintang forces, and the vitality of the communist-led rebel armies was such that within 4 short years, the Kuomintang was driven from mainland China to Formosa or Taiwan. In the case of Korea, the Soviets brought their army in agreement with the United States down to the 38th parallel, or stopped, or withdrew them to the 38th parallel, that same area that now divides North and South Korea. The reality is, the Soviet army could have taken all of Korea and had a communist-led Korea for the entire peninsula. They agreed to stop or to withdraw their forces back to the 38th parallel as a measure of goodwill towards the United States. That's how conservative their policy was. And what did the United States do? When the Japanese surrendered in August 1945, the General Order No. 1 by the U.S. occupation forces led by MacArthur instructed the Japanese to remain in place in South Korea, not to give up their power to local Koreans, even though they had been the colonizing power over Korea. MacArthur told them, remain in place and you be the governing, dominating power in liberated Korea until we, the Americans, arrive. And so between mid-August and September 8th, when the U.S. actually did arrive and then took control over the Korean military, Korean governance, so to speak, that was the time that the revolutionary nationalists and communists in Korea would have certainly been able to have taken the power, and certainly with the help of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union didn't challenge any of those demands by world imperialism because, again, its priority in Asia, like in Europe, was not to promote world revolution, but to have some sort of accommodation with imperialism, because the Soviets, more than anything, wanted a respite from war and confrontation.
What about the impact on Eastern Europe? It's oftentimes an area that is a bit of a contentious one when we talk about the subject of the Cold War.
Well, I think the socialist countries in Eastern Europe, with the exception of Yugoslavia, were far different from the revolutionary socialist governments in Korea or Vietnam or China, in the sense that the reason those governments came to power was because of the presence of the Soviet Red Army. In other words, it was an outside military force that tilted the relationship of forces. In Romania, for instance, you know, we hear so much about how Ceausescu was a totalitarian dictator. Of course, earlier, the West actually liked Ceausescu because he had a foreign policy that was independent of the Soviets and really tilted towards the West, in fact. But, you know, the background is this. In Romania, the Romanian military fought along with the Nazis against the Soviet Union until 1944, when the Soviets counterattacked and the Romanian military then switched sides. And instead of fighting with the Nazis, said they pledged fidelity to the Red Army. Clearly just a matter of expediency for themselves. And the Romanian Communist Party that had been slaughtered in a few years became the ruling party. There were probably 1,000 communists in all of Romania, and suddenly they were the ruling party because of the influence of the Red Army in determining the relationship of forces. And because, of course, as I said earlier, even though Stalin probably didn't care about Romanian communists coming to power, there was no other way to make sure that Romania wasn't sort of a semi-fascist or very right-wing nationalist anti-Soviet government under the conditions of the Cold War, except for the taking of political power, the governance by communist parties, even small and weak ones like the Romanian party. So Eastern Europe was always sort of a halfway house because it didn't have a revolution from below. It had a revolution from outside and from the top down. Many positive things happened. Medicine was socialized, full employment, education became free. The immense poverty in Eastern and Central Europe, a lot of it was ameliorated as a consequence of socialist policies. But that's still not the same thing as having an indigenous revolution where the energy, the creative energy of the masses is unleashed by virtue and in the process of revolution.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.